Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After the spending festival in Washington last summer, the new theme on Capitol Hill is cuts. Not nearly enough to offset the spending or close the deficit, but cuts anyway. And very broadly, here's how they tend to sort out. Cuts in support for the poor, cuts in taxes for the well-to-do. Late last week, the House passed an extension of President Bush's tax cuts on capital gains and dividends. Democrats say it's a giveaway to the rich, a vote for yachts and mansions. Republicans say it's fuel for the economy, a vote for jobs and growth. Meanwhile, the deficit and American inequality rage on. Up next on Point, who the tax cuts really help now and in the future. Joining me now from Washington is Jonathan Wiseman, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
I wish you'd walk us through the basics, Jonathan. What was the cut that was made in 2003? What was the extension that was approved by the House last week?
Well, in 2003, as kind of the centerpiece of President Bush's proposed tax cut, there was a $350 billion 10-year tax measure that focused on what the president wanted was what he called the elimination of the double taxation of dividends. It was a very complicated proposal that said that any dividend income that came out of fully taxed corporate profits would be completely tax-free. Congress took that and decided it was a little too complicated, and so they simply set a 15% tax rate on dividends and a 15% tax rate on capital gains. So if you were a very high-income person, and a lot of dividend recipients are, and your top tax rate was 38.5% at the time, then your dividend income would be taxed at 38.5%. Well, just by slapping a 15% flat rate on it, that was a very deep cut to dividends. Capital gains went down largely from about 20% to about 15% as well.
So if you were selling assets or you owned dividend-paying stocks, this was a great cut. This meant a lot of extra money in your pocket.
That's right. And it was supposed to be a very big inducement for companies to start offering dividends from the hoard of cash they were sitting on, or to increase the dividends that they were offering.
And, of course, many have offered dividends, but they're still sitting on a lot of cash at the same time. Now, what did the House vote to do last week, Jonathan?
Last week, the House voted to take the dividend and capital gains tax cuts, which are set to expire at the end of 2008, and extend them through 2010. It was a two-year extension of tax cuts that aren't actually supposed to expire for a few more years. That the Senate had the opportunity to do this as well, but the Senate Finance Committee refused to do it because they had one Republican, Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, who would not do it. She said it was inappropriate to cut taxes for the rich at a time when they were cutting programs for the poor, and the Finance Committee could not pass a dividend and capital gains tax out of committee, so they brought to the floor a bill that is very different from the House's and does not have anything on dividends and capital gains taxes.
All that remains to be resolved, and of course anything could come out of that, including, I suppose, even now, the Senate flipping over to the House version. Is that still a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. The Olympia Snowe had enormous amounts of power in the Finance Committee, which is very evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. But the Republican leadership in the Senate believes if they bring a dividend and capital gains tax cut to the floor of the Senate, they will get more than 50 votes. And remember, this is all being done under a parliamentary rule. It's very complicated, but it's under a parliamentary rule that makes the tax cut bill unfilibusterable. In other words, it only needs 51 votes to pass instead of the 60 votes often needed for Senate approval.
And this comes in a context of cuts in programs, as Democrats and some Republicans do not tire of pointing out, in programs that would support the poor, such as, Jonathan?
Well, some of the most the steepest cuts would go to the Medicaid program. Under those cuts, the states would be allowed to impose higher fees, deductibles, or co-payments on poor people who are receiving Medicaid. There's also a very deep cut to federal assistance for child support enforcement. There are cuts to student loan programs, and the food stamp rolls would also be trimmed by restricting eligibility to food stamps.
What about it? Where does the benefit of these tax cuts primarily fall, Jonathan?
Well, it depends on how you look at these things. If you're looking at direct benefit, if you're saying, okay, if we're going to cut a dollar of capital gains taxes or a dollar of dividend taxes, where does that dollar go? If you look at the direct benefit, it is almost impossible to not argue that most of the benefit goes to the affluent. About 73.6% of the tax cut that passed the House on Thursday went to the top 10%, and the top 1% got more than half of it. Now, the Republicans would counter that that's just not a good way to look at tax cuts on investment, that if you cut the tax rates on investment, you get more investment that grows the economy, and that ultimately a growing economy will lead to higher employment rates, and ultimately with a tight labor market, you're going to get a rise in salaries and wages as well. So if you look at the broader benefits of the tax cuts, they would argue that everybody will benefit and the poor will benefit as well as the rich.
Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
I'm joined now from Washington by Leonard Berman, senior fellow at the Urban Institute. He's co-director of the Tax Policy Center there, author of The Labyrinth of Capital Gains Tax Policy, a guide for the perplexed. That might be us. Leonard Berman, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also with us from Washington, Kevin Hassett, resident scholar and director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Hassett, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So we really want to try and crack through this, and I don't know if it's possible. We've been talking about trickle-down for, 20, 30 years now, and I'm not sure that's the right label to put on this yet again. But Kevin Hassett, a couple of questions. Number one, do these kind of tax cuts fuel that growth? And is there something wrong with the growth, even when it's happening, if the deficit's still there?
I think that these kind of tax cuts are an important contributing factor, but it would be wrong to attribute the lion's share of growth to Bush tax policy. Bush tax policies have really fiddled around the edges, more or less, and the reason why the economy is growing very well right now is that productivity is advancing sharply, and economists really don't understand productivity all that well. So I think that you know, chance should get the lion's share of the credit, not the tax cuts. But I don't think that there's a lot of dispute amongst economists that taxes should distort capital formation as little as possible. And so there's really quite a bit of intellectual support for the Bush move or the Republicans' move to reduce taxes on capital as they have in this latest episode. And so you know, do lower capital taxes lead to higher growth? There is some cross-country evidence on that. Whether it's doing it this time or not is something that you know, we don't have enough data yet to judge.
Leonard Berman, coming here with your interpretation, Americans all in all are remarkably open to the rich being treated well as long as they have confidence that they personally have a shot at it and that it works for the whole economy. When we look at these tax cuts that go primarily to upper income, to the wealthy, do they make sense for the whole economy?
Well, one problem is that the tax cuts haven't been paid for by other spending cuts, which was part of the rhetoric behind them in the first place. These tax cuts are all financed by deficits, and they're all going to have to be paid back by somebody, our children, grandchildren. And frankly, we don't know when the dust settles who's paying for this, because it hasn't been specified. It's all been just added to the debt. Now, the other thing is that, you know, whatever, there are positive effects from lowering marginal tax rates. The effects of cutting taxes on capital, I think we should talk about, because it depends on how you do it, and I don't think we've done it in a very sensible way. You want to do it in a way that doesn't stimulate a rash of tax shelters. If you have individuals and companies that are making decisions based on where they can save taxes rather than where the highest economic return is, you could actually have investments that are unproductive. You have companies and individuals taking scarce resources and investing them in projects that don't pay a good rate of return. The other problem is that since we're financing this with deficits, The government's borrowing is crowding out private investment. Right now, we haven't seen much of an effect of that because there's been a flood of foreign capital that's kept our interest rates low. That's not going to persist forever.
We're joined right now on the phone by listener Phoenix from Middleborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Phoenix. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm actually from Alabama, but I'm delivering up here. I'm a truck driver.
Great. Great to have you, Phoenix. What do you think?
Over the last couple of years, last year I got a 2 cent raise a mile, and this year I'm supposed to get another 2 cent raise.
Is that a good raise, Phoenix, for us who aren't truck drivers?
Yeah, yes, sir, it is.
Okay.
But there's an old saying, it goes, I never worked for a poor man. But at the same time, when you guys was talking about, you know, the 1%, the top 1%.
Yes.
You know, basically that's people that are skimming off the top, and really the tax break should go to the people that owns the backbone of the country, the smaller businesses and things like that.
So where do you end up coming down on it, Phoenix? Are you for the tax cuts or not?
Well, I'm for it, you know, to an extent, but just to an extent. What I'm saying is that if the top 1%, if they don't invest it in foreign investment and then reinvest it back in our country, then it would be all right. And it would work, and it would be okay.
We've got it. I think I got it loud and clear. There's that voice that says, look, this is fine as long as it works. Phoenix there, Alabama truck driver calling in from on the road. I want to bring another voice in to help respond and look at this situation. David K. Johnston joins us. He's Pulitzer Prize-winning financial reporter for the New York Times, author of Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. So you see he comes at it from an angle. He spent a lot of time looking at American tax policy. David K. Johnston, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So you heard right there in the phone call from Phoenix, he's saying, I don't oppose this if it works. But does it work? Do you see the dividend tax cuts that we're actually getting, the capital gains tax cuts we're actually extending, as working for the whole country, David?
Well, with the proviso that it's been in effect for a very short period of time, and if there's a widely held belief that it won't be permanent, that distorts the kind of effect we get. The fact is, as Led Berman pointed out earlier, that none of these tax cuts have paid for themselves, which is a very important item. What we're doing with these tax cuts, which go very heavily to the top. In the first 15 years, the Bush tax cuts, if the president gets what he wants in his budget, 53% of the cuts go to the top 10%, and 15% of the cuts go to the top one-tenth of 1%.
Wow.
It's crucial to keep in mind that taxes are only part of the flow. It's the flow into the government from the tax system, but we're borrowing like mad. And the minute that we have the economy slow down, we have interest rates go up, we have some unwillingness by foreign buyers to buy American debt, we're going to have the government competing in this limited pool of capital, which, by the way, at the moment, the world seems to be awash with capital.
Right.
We don't seem to need to create incentives for capital. If anything, we have a glut of savings.
So what does that when the bill comes due for the borrowing that's behind the tax cuts? I mean, people already say, well, of course, the rich benefit from the cuts because the rich pay a lot of taxes. When the bill comes due for the borrowing, will that fall on the same class, the top 5 and 1 and 1/10 of 1%? If they're going to pay it eventually, maybe it's okay.
Well, we're already seeing the bill begin to come due by cutting spending. And the areas in which we're cutting spending are not those things that benefit the very wealthiest people in America. We haven't been cutting spending for extending runways so that little airports can handle corporate jets. Instead, we're seeing proposals to cut spending for those programs that benefit the poor, that provide for veterans, you know, who come back and have been wounded or injured in some way. Those are the areas where we're seeing cuts. So clearly, at least at the moment, the political tenor is not to make those who got the greatest benefit of the cuts bear the greatest burden of paying for those.
Kevin Hassett, how about it? We're borrowing to pay for tax cuts, David K. Johnston says again. Nobody knows where the bill for that's going to fall. In the meantime, people at different end, the other end of the income spectrum are paying in cuts. Does this add up to equity, to fairness?
I think that David and Lynn are both correct to emphasize that government spending has not been cut along with the taxes, or its growth has not been held back. And that's a point where the current Republicans are logically inconsistent. So if they want to have tax cuts, then they need to constrain the growth of government. Government spending under President Bush has gone up by more than for any other president since the Second World War, even in percentage terms, even out, if you exclude Homeland Security and defense.
Wow.
And so he has been increasing spending a heck of a lot, and that's where the problem comes from. And so then to turn around and say, oh, but he's cutting the spending that harms the poor, I mean, maybe there are specific episodes where you can say maybe that thing didn't grow as fast or so on, but on the whole, all of these spending programs have skyrocketed. And so right now, I think that nobody's really paying for this deficit. Down the road, I would guess that it would come from both. That it would come from tax hikes and eventually from slower spending. And the spending part, is, as David correctly points out, would be cutting programs that are targeted towards the bottom half, and the income tax part would be targeting people at the top.
Kurt is calling from Coggin, Iowa. Hi, Kurt. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, and I really appreciate your show and the conversation that your guests are having. I wanted to interject, and I didn't tell your screener this, I'm a Presbyterian minister. What I wanted to interject in this conversation was human nature and just appeal to a sense of common sense and to past history, just looking at how human beings respond, the haves and the have-nots. And I'm not trying to demonize rich people at all. That's not fair. That's not right. Just like demonizing all poor people and saying they're on the take.
So what does human nature tell you, Kurt?
Well, human nature tells me that if you're going to rely on individuals that already have a lot to give them more, so they will go ahead and take that money and invest it into the economy, create more jobs, high-paying jobs, evidently with adequate health benefits and that sort of thing, that's just not going to happen. I like what I think your guest Lynn has been pointing out, which is, and people are going to, if the good times are rolling right now, this administration is supporting tax cuts, that could change in the next administration. So I would guess that what's happening is they're thinking, we need to put this in tax shelters. We need to save this. While we've got this money coming in, we need to save this. We need to hoard this. And that's the human nature aspect of that we all struggle against.
But what if, in principle, having low taxes on capital does fuel an economy? If that's true, Pastor Kurt, is there some point at which, even if it works, you would oppose it, or you'd oppose it no matter what kind of stratosphere, class of wealth it creates?
I don't oppose the idea. I think I echo what Phoenix and others have said. Where's the proof in that? I told your screen, look back in the, and I'm not an economist, I'm a theologian, but you look back in the market crash in 1929. My understanding is that there was a flood of credit, there was a flood of cash, we were top-heavy in terms of our debt, and the people that had a lot did not put that back into the economy. They hoarded that, and as a result, the economy came to a grounding halt. I know it had to do with other things that were going on.
It had to do with a lot of things, but Kurt, we've got it. The preacher's beat on human nature there. David K. Johnston, what about it? You can feel Americans really searching their gut, trying to do the right thing, trying to be fair, trying to be smart here. How do you respond to Kurt in Iowa?
Well, one of the principal things we have to keep in mind here is that it matters what we spend our taxes on and what our economy is doing. Capital is going to seek the best return it can get. And if the best return it can get because of the rules the government has set are to invest that capital overseas and create jobs overseas, then that's what capital should be doing. So we need to fundamentally look at the rules and that Congress has set and the effect that they're having on our economy. Now, the caller who talked about debt from college, I think, raised a very important point. The most valuable asset we have is human minds. And we've gone from a system in which public education at the higher levels was very inexpensive after World War II up until the early 70s, to which it's become prohibitively expensive for lots of smart but poor kids. And I think those kinds of questions need to be part of the tax debate, the one-sided, a one-dimensional debate. What's the marginal rate of tax?
Mm-hmm.
Will lead us to all sorts of distortions. We need to have a much broader debate.
And you're saying that there's no perfect answer here, so debate it more broadly. I mean, at bottom, people want to, when they're talking about tax rates, and that is the subject today, if it's just going into mansions and yachts, that's disturbing. If it's firing things up, that's not as disturbing.
Well, of course, money you spend, you know, building a house or fixing a house does create jobs, but it is not particularly an efficient way to do it. And, you know, the world around us is changing, and our tax policies, I think, are not broadly taking into account how they're changing.
Kevin Hassett, what about it? We see this increasing income inequality. It increased under Bill Clinton as well. Is there a point at which you, with your economic outlook here, say this is too much? This has bad after effects, even if it lines up with my economic philosophy.
Well, the problem is, given the tax structure we have, that if pretty much with the bottom half of the income distribution not paying tax and the top half paying tax, that when we're having a tax debate about whether the top rate should be 35 or 30 and the bottom rate should be 15 or 10, then we're moving money around in the top half of the income distribution. And to the extent that we screw it up, then we're going to hurt the economy, and the people who bear the brunt of that damage are going to be people at the bottom. And so for me, I'm willing to have less redistribution between, you know, the guy in the 60th percentile and the guy in the 99th, because I think that it does have positive economic benefits to have lower marginal rates, and that benefit goes to the people at the bottom because they're the first ones to lose their job when there's a downturn and so on. And so I think the problem is that the fairness debate too often is really misapplied to the tax debate, because the redistribution in the income tax is really in the top half of the income distribution.
And Lynn Berman, is that bottom line? You've got a minute left here. Is that how you'd look at it, or should we take a different view?
No, I don't look at it that way. First of all, people pay federal taxes at all income levels, if you include payroll taxes and corporate taxes as well. The other thing is that the federal income tax actually does play a significant role in lessening some of the bad effects of the economy. The earned income tax credit, the refundable child tax credit help people at the bottom. And those have been fought tooth and nail by conservatives all along the way. But I think, you know, we need something to guarantee that people at all levels of the income distribution gain from economic growth and not just people at the very top.
And as you say, watch out, friends, when the bill comes due. Lynn Berman at the Urban Institute, co-director of the Tax Policy Center there, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
And Kevin Hassett at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Hassett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great.
David K. Johnston with the New York Times, always good to hear from you. The book is perfectly legal, and off we go. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.